Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We turn our attention to the markets this week. U.S. CPI numbers reinforcing concerns about inflation.
And the financial stories that shape our world.
A really different reaction to markets. More indications of just how hot the U.S. economy really is.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Catherine Keating, CEO of BNY Mellon.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Sam Zell, chairman and founder of Equity Group Investments.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Drones hit Moscow, lower numbers hit China, and Washington works hard not to hit the debt ceiling. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, special contributor Larry Summers of Harvard on the stubbornly strong labor market and what it means for inflation.
There's something about the underlying strength of the economy that they're missing.
And former IBM CEO Sam Palmisano on just how big generative AI could get and what could stop it.
You need some kind of a cognition capability, which it does not have.
Wall Street started the week watching drone hits in Moscow, perhaps as a precursor to a counteroffensive in Ukraine.
We're able to reach you right in the heart of Russia, and these attacks are really about sort of like sending that message. So it's quite embarrassing for Russia that this is happening.
We spent another week on the debt ceiling in Washington, but this time it wasn't about getting a deal, but about getting it all behind us, at least for a couple of years.
We're going to deal with the debt ceiling. I think things are going as planned.
Tonight, we all made history, because this is the biggest cut and savings this Congress has ever voted for.
And as expected, not everyone was happy.
Not one Republican should vote for this deal. Not one.
China got some bad economic news, raising more questions about the speed of its recovery.
China's manufacturing activity contracted for a second straight month in May. It's more evidence that the post-COVID recovery has slowed in the world's second largest economy.
But here in the United States, the jobs machine, well, it just kept on going, adding 339,000 new jobs in the month of May. That was way more than the 195,000 that was estimated, while unemployment actually rose up from 3.4% to 3.7%, which set the markets off to the races, with the S&P 500 up 1.83% for the week, almost all of it on Friday alone. The NASDAQ was up a bit more, adding 2.04% for the week, while the bond markets almost did a round trip, starting the week just under 3.8% on the 10-year yield, dipping well below 3.6% at one point, and then coming back to just under 3.7% on Friday as people returned to thinking about possible rate hikes. To take us through the week in the markets, welcome now Barbara Reinhart. She's Voya Capital Head of Asset Allocation, and Aaron Brown, PIMCO Multi-Asset Strategy Portfolio Manager. So welcome back to both of you. Great to have you here. Barbara, let me start with you about what we're seeing in the markets. We saw some numbers on Friday that indicate the economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs. Mm-hmm. How are the markets reacting to all this information?
It was a strange employment report, right? So it didn't coincide with necessarily some of the other data that we're looking at, such as NFIB, hiring intentions, the home base data. They would have told you that the labor market would have been a lot weaker than the number that we had printed today. But the good news is, and that what the equity market held on to, is the gentle decline in average hourly earnings. And that is good news on the inflation side, because you've had very sticky inflation. It's been coming down, but coming down probably slower than what people expected. But to see the easing in the wage data is a very good positive development.
Barbara, we've heard an awful lot about this lag in the effects from monetary policy. How long a lag should we expect? Because, boy, it doesn't seem to be showing up very profoundly so far.
So it tends to be about, when the Federal Reserve started hiking interest rates, it was about 14 months ago. There tends to be a lag of about 24 months between when the Fed starts hiking and when you start to see a dramatic slowdown in inflation. That means we should have at least the rest of this year into the first quarter of 24 before you start to see a significant slowdown in inflation. Look, when you look at things like the sticky price CPI or the underlying inflation gauge, they were at, between 6 and 7% just 6 months ago. They're down now to about 3.5% to 4.5%, well above the Fed's target, but they're going in the right direction. In order to get down to the 2% on inflation, which is the Fed's target, you likely need to see a little bit more time go by. Think about this, David. The real issue is that the Fed hikes, the 75 basis points that they did over the course of 3 or 4 meetings last year, they happened in the third and fourth quarters of last year. You need at least 12 months for that to start to be felt by the economy and start to see the slowdown. You're seeing it in some of the data change indexes. You're starting to see some slowing. Certainly not indicative of the labor market this morning on that report, but I would say that data can change and can change relatively quickly.
It's not just U.S. investors who drive U.S. markets. We also pay attention to foreign investors in U.S. securities. And Torsten Slok of Apollo is here with one of his charts to show where foreign investors are putting their money.
So before the pandemic, there was appetite among foreigners for buying, in particular, U.S. government bonds and also U.S. equities. Foreigners have also historically bought a lot of U.S. credit, but broadly speaking, the trends were that foreigners had appetite for buying both U.S. fixed income and buying U.S. equities. So over the months ahead, we still have that the Federal Reserve is doing quantitative tightening to the tune of roughly $60 billion every single month. At the same time, we also have a budget deficit, which is roughly around 5% of GDP, and that amounts to roughly, in round numbers, about $100 billion in issuance of treasuries every single month. Combining both QT and the budget deficit with this new issuance on the other side of this debt ceiling deal now potentially being quite substantial, it does raise questions about who is it that will be buying treasuries, in particular in an environment where the hedging costs for foreigners continue to be quite elevated.
Aaron Brown of PIMCO and Barbara Reinhart of Voya are still with us. So Aaron, let me start with you here. We've been following this after the debt ceiling got put behind us, as fortunately it did this week. There's the question of replenishing the larder, essentially, in the U.S. Treasury to get their stock back up. It's going to be a lot of T-bills. Do we have the buyers for those T-bills?
Yeah, as Torsten mentioned, I mean, the challenge is from a foreigner's perspective. If you're a Japanese investor and you're looking to buy 10-year government bonds, after the FX hedging costs, measured by the sort of 3-month FX forward hedge, it will cost you negative 2%. Your yield that you're getting is about negative 2.2% on a 10-year bond. You can buy JGBs for about 40 basis points. So from a foreigner's perspective, it's better to buy the local bonds than T to take into account the FX hedging costs and buy a U.S. Treasury bond, even though U.S. Treasuries, at least from a yield perspective in the U.S., is yielding more. So it's really unattractive right now just because of FX hedging costs to buy U.S. government bonds from a foreigner's perspective. You know, there's another a wrinkle that I'm going to throw into, you know, the challenge that we have with respect to supply. Not only do we need to refill the coffers of the TGA, and we have to fund the fiscal deficit, but also keep in mind from an international perspective, you're going to start to have the TLTROs also that are going to start adding to additional supply in Europe as well. So you have a lot of government supply that's going to be hitting the market in the second half of this year, which is going to create a challenge certainly in terms of or raise a question in terms of who's going to be the incremental buyer for that. The problem with the debt ceiling being passed, I mean, it's good from a political perspective and good from a stability perspective, but it does mean that you now have to refill those coffers. There's going to be a significant amount of issuance over the next couple of months, and the Treasury is saying that they want to rebuild to about $600 billion that TGA, which means a significant amount of issuance over the next 3 to 4 months.
So, Barbara, I'm just going to say, I hadn't thought about the TLTRO issue, but whatever it is, what's it going to do to liquidity in the marketplace, and what could that mean as a practical matter? That money's got to come from someplace.
It does, but a lot of times you're talking about cash buyers moving over to a different cash instrument. In the past 20 years, there have been four times that the Treasury general account has had to raise significant amount of assets like it is this time. Each time it was able to do it without an issue. We don't rule out that something could potentially be amiss this time and cause some indigestion, but the Fed is very well versed in the plumbing of the Treasury market, and we don't think that it's necessarily going to be a very big issue for the front end market. Plus, also think about this. You're now getting interest rates that are almost in excess of headline inflation to be parked in T-bills, right? So it's just a very attractive investment for many investors. And many of the bank depositors are looking at the T-bill market thinking, I can go over to money markets and get much better rates of interest. So I think there's going to be a lot of natural buyers.
Thank you so very much to Barbara Reinhart of Voya Capital and Aaron Brown of PIMCO. Well, now this week, we mark the 100th birthday of Henry Kissinger, the man who laid the foundation for the most important economic relationship in the world. That was, of course, the one between the United States and China. So we went back and found an interview Dr. Kissinger did with Louis Rukeyser back in 1990 when China's GDP was a mere $360 billion compared to the $18 trillion that it is today.
Do you think we still have important economic opportunities in China?
I think we do, and I'm in favor of maintaining a working relationship with China. It is too important a country. It had made good progress in economic reform, and I think we should not lightly sacrifice a relationship with the country with the longest continuing history in Asia, with the cultural influence that it has.
This is Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's S-T-I-F-E-L.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Artificial intelligence, it's been with us for longer than we think. Bank of America's Brian Moynihan says they've been using it for at least 5 years.
We have this thing called Erica, which is a virtual artificial intelligence, virtual assistant, natural language processing, predictive technology that we've been running for 4 or 5 years.
And people like JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon insist that it is transformational.
AI is real. This is not...
Not crypto?
That's not crypto. This is a technology which is staggering.
With AI pioneer Samuel Altman telling Congress,
we think it can be a printing press moment. We have to work together to make it so.
But now there are those who are warning about some of the downsides, with tech veterans like Carly Fiorina agreeing with OpenAI's Samuel Altman that there needs to be regulation.
Big tech has to say, we alone are not in charge, and we alone cannot control this.
And a group of AI industry leaders this week wrote an open letter warning that what they are building could lead to a risk of extinction.
And to take us through some of the possible impediments to generative AI, as well as the risks involved, welcome now Sam Palmisano. He is now the chairman of the Center for Global Enterprise, but of course, for many years, he was the chair and CEO of IBM. So Sam, welcome back to Wall Street Week. Really great to have you here. Let's start, first of all, with exactly how big this generative AI could be. We've seen NVIDIA this week really explode in its market capitalization. Is it overhyped, do you think? Is it as big as people say?
David, well, first of all, thank you for having me. No, I think it's that big. This is transformational technology, but it's early stage. But, I mean, I always draw the analogy to the internet, because if you think back where it began, exchanging technical documents around the world in the 70s to what it's become today, 50 years later, a lot happened in innovation and development and regulation and guidance, et cetera. All that has to happen with generative AI or large language models. But it is that transformational, because like the browser for the internet made it kind of user-friendly for people to actually get in there and look up information or search, this will do the same thing as far as AI is concerned for people to use natural language to interface to it and get responses that are very much like human being responses.
So if it is transformational, as you say, what are we going to need to have it be that transformational? What are some of the key inputs? Let's start, for example, with microchips. That's what's driving NVIDIA to a large degree, and maybe some other chip manufacturers as well. What is the need there?
Well, basically, this is going to be, it requires massive infrastructure. And today you think about it as hyperscalers is the term, or cloud computing service providers like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, et cetera. Having said that, this is huge demands on capacity and performance of that capacity, therefore the chips. And the advantage that NVIDIA has is these things, graphical processing units that are called GPUs. Those technologies themselves are much better performers than the classic Intel chip, which is referred to as x86 technology. So fundamentally, you need that level of performance to run this, like these natural language models, because they're so large, the data sets are so large and require so many interconnections that you need the performance to be acceptable to the end user.
One of the things we hear about is energy also. It didn't seem that long ago that we were talking about crypto mining and what a big drain that was for energy. In fact, China really cut back on some of the mining there in China. What is the demand potentially in this transformational generative AI or LLM? What is the demand for energy?
Oh, it's the same as all these large cloud service data centers. I mean, it's massive. I mean, you could model those as if they're nuclear reactors. That's how much energy they consume. Now, there's a lot that can be done, I mean, quite honestly, around the utilization of this infrastructure to cut the energy costs. There's ways you can use green energy to supplement the classical forms of electricity and those sorts of things. But there are lots of techniques associated with how to reduce that, but energy is going to be significant. There's no doubt about it. It already is. I mean, it has been for years in these large, whether they were supercomputers in the old days or now the cloud infrastructure providers, it's the same issue. They require significant amounts of energy.
So, Sam, we've heard an awful lot about the wonderful things that generative AI could bring us, not least of which is increased productivity. There are remarkable projections here of trillions of dollars of increased production because of generative AI. Then we had a letter that came out this week from a group of AI experts, people who know about this, warning about the risks and even saying there's a risk of extinction if we're not careful. Is that overblown?
Well, okay, let me tell you what the risks are. I don't know if it's extinction, but the risks are, quite honestly, this technology makes you feel like you're actually getting something that's correct, you know, right? But it's not. It's not valid. And what it's doing basically at the engineering design is connecting large-scale words together. But there's no checking to the source of the words. There's no fact-checking as to conclusions these words reach. In some cases, it's a terrific essay that it's prepared. Maybe it's a great book that it's written or a wonderful poem. But at the end of the day, if you need accuracy, and you have to have accuracy, like in healthcare, if you were depending upon your diagnostics, you would not use ChatGPT. I mean, you want to have a doctor or some human of some kind that looked at the conclusion that it reached, even though it probably read all the medical journals like we did in Watson Health. You need some kind of a cognition capability, which it does not have. I think people get confused by what it does have because it's so easy to use. It's very, very attractive. There's no doubt about it. But it needs to be enhanced with some of these capabilities that will address the concerns that are in that article today about worrying about it could be like nuclear warfare in the future. I mean, if you think about applications that could have a short-term impact that you would like to have facts but don't have any facts, take political propaganda as an example of that, or political campaigns. I mean, you'd like to have some facts and all that information, but we all know they don't exist, and I'm not sure that the proponents of all that information really want the facts out there anyway.
Sam, is that risk, is that weakness about actually truth-checking, is that inherent in large language models? Is it inherent in generative AI? Or is it something with new iterations, actually, it could take over itself so it could actually check itself?
What needs to be done is the self-checking, like you said. That does not exist today. I make the argument that the inventors of this technology that are raising all these alarms knew about these alarms, and they could have written some of these checkers, these tracing of the information or transparency of the data into the actual technology itself. Now, however, you know, I understand that they raise the concerns. They are very, very valid concerns. However, if you are the inventor or the guys coming up with this technology, you knew this and you could have prepared for this, but now it has to be done. I mean, it's great technology, it's transformational, but now it has to be done, and it will be done, and there's going to be lots of small innovative companies that are going to take advantage of that gap and add that capability.
What's the government to do?
It depends, you know, right? This is a great dilemma, and I take you back to the early days of the Internet. I mean, in the early days of the Internet, the government decided to take a light hand of guidance to the Internet, and the reason being that they would like to see the innovation grow and accelerate before they actually put the regulations in place. And they're still trying to do that today as you look at data privacy and those kinds of issues, which are very, very valid issues. And this is the same thing. I think in the beginning, how do you regulate something that you don't know what it is? And we really don't know. We have concerns about what it could be, but that's not what it is today. So my suggestion to the people that are raising all these concerns is they work with the technologists, the private sector, the academic universities, government regulations, and come up with guardrails, not regulations. Because once you put this in law or code, it never gets reversed. And I don't think we know enough today to put that in a responsible way, put that in place. I know some of the founders of the technology are calling for that. I understand understand why they're raising those concerns. However, it's the actual details that matter in this case. And you're trading off innovation because you could solve massive societal problems with this technology.
Okay, Sam, it's always such a pleasure to have you here on Wall Street. We've got Sam Palmisano. He is now the chairman of the Center for Global Enterprise. Coming up, we wrap up the week with our special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. We're joined once again by a very special contributor here. He is Larry Summers of Harvard. So, Larry, we have to start with those jobs numbers that came out on Friday. A lot more than expected, 339,000 jobs. At the same time, we also had an increase in wages, and we had an increase in unemployment. What do you make of this surprise number, I think, for most people?
Look, I think these are strong numbers in toto. 339,000 jobs is a lot. There were upward revisions for the previous 2 months. We've always known that the monthly unemployment rate is a very noisy series. That's especially true in May when you got all the seasonal adjustments going on with respect to the kids who are leaving school and looking for summer jobs. So I think you have to read this report as strong. I think the forecasting community's got to do a little soul searching. They've been low on this report for 14 months in a row. That has got to suggest that there's something about the underlying strength of the economy that they're missing. Or another way to put it is that they are exaggerating the impact and efficacy of monetary policy in slowing the economy down. So I read these as a strong report, and I think the general tendency of the data has been very much towards saying that the economy, at least for this while, has a fair amount of robustness in it.
Going beyond the jobs numbers out this week, the other big development of the economy, I dare say, is that package that did make it through, actually, the Congress, that took care of the debt ceiling problem. I wonder what you make of that package, and maybe more specifically, what it means for the fiscal policy of the United States of America.
David, before I say something about the debt limit issues, I want to just say that with that behind us, with these employment figures, with the general evidence of robustness in the economy, I think the lower risk strategy is for the Fed to raise rates in June. It's a close call. And if they don't raise rates in June, I think they have to be open to the possibility that they may have to raise rates by 50 basis points in July if the economy continues to stay way hot and if inflation figures are robust. I saw that some of the governors have been saying that maybe the Fed can move to a mode of raising rates by 25 basis points only every other meeting. It's certainly possible that that's a mode that they can move into, but for there to be any sense of commitment to that, given the risks, would I think be repeating the kind of mistakes that the Fed has made repeatedly over the last several years. I vacillated after the first run of serious banking issues, but seeing where we are now, seeing the general picture in markets, I think we are again in a situation where the risks of overheating the economy are the primary risks that the Fed needs to be mindful of. And of course, that's just reinforced by the fact that we've put the debt limit and the potential loss of confidence from it very much behind us by reaching this deal. Look, the thing I'm worried about coming out of this deal is not what happens in the near term. The IRS provisions there, I think, are really a serious error, and we're missing a chance to catch lots of people who have just cheated on their taxes, who are going to go undiscovered. And because we're not investing enough, we're going to probably have even more people playing the audit lottery. And that's a mistake, a serious mistake. But I think the really big issue that focus is going to need to turn to is the long-run fiscal picture of the country. CBO says that we're headed to a projected deficit more than twice as large as the one we had when we set off the Simpson-Bowles process, more than 75% larger than the one that was there when Bill Clinton came in as president. And there are all sorts of reasons to think that the CBO estimate is way optimistic. I don't believe for a moment that 1 month, 3 month Treasury bill rates are going to average 2.3% over the next decade. I don't believe for a moment that defense spending as a share of GDP is going to fall by 20% over the next decade. If anybody believes that 100% of the Trump tax cuts are going to be terminated when they come up for renewal in 2025, I'd be happy to make them a bet, or even happier to sell them a bridge, because they're very gullible. So I think if you look at the numbers in the right serious way, you're looking at projected budget deficit that could approach or exceed 10% of GDP.
Well, that's fascinating, Larry, because I don't want to say you're sounding a little bit like Kevin McCarthy, but you are concerned about the deficit and the debt. Let me talk to you about how we should look at that problem. You just talked about the ratio of the debt to the GDP. You wrote a paper with Jason Furman a few years back saying it really is the question of the size of the debt service against GDP. There's a report in Bloomberg this week that said that's what Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, is looking at, and that as she looks at that ratio, it's not that disturbing. Should we be disturbed looking at it through that lens?
Look, when you look at it in terms of debt service, David, what that depends on, obviously, is what the level of the interest rate is. And if you believe CBO that the 1 month or 3 month Treasury rate is going to stay below 2.5 for 10 years, then you can be serene about debt service. But that's a kind of assume a can opener approach. My guess, given all the debt that we're accumulating, given what the Fed's going to have to do to contain inflation, is that rates are going to have to be substantially higher than that. And if you take a more realistic approach, you are looking at debt service levels that, whether you use the nominal interest rate or the real interest rate, are getting very close to the levels that Furman and I said would be dangerous. So I think it's absolutely right to focus on debt service as the issue, but we have, in part because of all the massive QE, where the Fed, which is, after all, an arm of the government, has bought up all the long-term bonds, we're now running the country's finances like a homeowner with a floating-rate mortgage.
So, Larry, finally, put this all together, if you would. Take the really robust jobs numbers that we've talked about, put it together with what you're admonishing the Fed. They should be at least willing to put on the table 50 basis point rate hikes in order to get our arms around inflation, given how strong the economy is. Where are you now on recession? Because people have been talking about recession for a long time. You've been talking about it. I've been talking about it. A lot of people have. We keep putting out the time for it. Where are you on the likelihood of recession, and when is it hit?
David, I still think that it is soft landings are very unlikely, that it's unlikely that inflation will come down to the 2 range without an economic downturn. And in a way, it's a policy choice when that downturn comes. And we have put it off. The worry is that when you delay taking your medication, and then you only take part of your medication till you feel better, you don't really get cured, and there ends up being more pain down the road. It sure doesn't look to me like we're going near recession before the end of the summer. And if I had to guess right now, I think the Fed will end up doing enough to restrain inflation, and that's going to mean a quite soft economy sometime in 2024. But the dynamics are very difficult to gauge.
Okay, Larry, it's always such a pleasure having you with us. That's Larry Summers of Harvard, our special contributor here on Wall Street Week. Coming up, what do you do when you can't believe your own eyes or ears or even your own lawyer? That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Investing that takes into account environmental, social, and governance issues has been all the rage, with Bloomberg estimating that ESG funds will reach over $50 trillion worldwide by 2025. But the issue has become increasingly politicized in the United States, in sharp contrast with Europe and with Canada. To explain that gap and where it could take us, we welcome now Eileen O'Connor, Rockefeller Foundation Senior Vice President for Strategic Communications and Policy. So, Eileen, thank you so much for joining us. What are you hearing in terms of a divergence, possible divergence between Europe and the United States?
Well, there's incredible frustration of U.S. pension funds because they understand that this is actually bad for business and particularly bad for their investors. And we're already seeing that in some conservative states where there's proposed anti-ESG legislation. Some of those even Republican pension fund managers are pushing back and saying that it's going to cost their pensioners billions of dollars, both in fees to convert and to pull out of investments, but also in losses over the next few years. And the reason for this is that if the United States businesses don't start investing in the technologies that are going to abate greenhouse gas emissions and also adapt to a warming climate, we are going to be losing out as a country and as an economy because Europe and Asia, and particularly China, are investing in these technologies because they understand that climate change is very real, that human activity and fossil fuels are major causes, as well as some of the ways we grow our food and use other technologies. And so they are now already converting their energy systems. They are investing in battery storage, electric vehicles, electric stoves, and other things. And the United States business, if there is a chilling effect by this anti-ESG legislation, it's business that's going to lose out, and also consumers and the economy in general.
Before you even get to the investments, you can talk to just about talking about it, because we're having difficulty sometimes getting people even to come on and talk about the issue because it's so politicized. And there's actually partisan politics going on with people's houses. They're sending up picket lines at people's houses. Are you having a difficult time getting even people to discuss it publicly?
Yes. I'm also was a corporate lawyer, and I've been speaking to some of my former partners who are representing companies and who are basically afraid to talk about the fact that these investments are good investments. I mean, over the years, investing in new technologies has driven down the cost of solar and is driving down the cost of battery storage. These are very good investments, and they will actually lead to economic growth. The other thing is these businesses know that they have to also, you know, they have to address climate change because they have to address the risk of climate change. We already know that even this year alone, we've had $7 billion climate weather events. That's what NOAA calls them. They actually caused over $1 billion worth of loss and damage to businesses and to people in the United States. And those instances are rising tremendously over the last few years. And so that is another thing that businesses want to do. They want to make profit, but they want to avoid cost, obviously. And so that's a risk that they are also looking at. And I would also say that, you know, interestingly, Norway's sovereign wealth fund is really taking that risk seriously. They're basically saying that they're not going to invest in companies that don't take mitigation of climate risk into account when they're making investments. They will actually disinvest from those companies, is what they're saying in a statement.
I mean, it's really great to talk to you. Thank you so much. That's Eileen O'Connor of the Rockefeller Foundation. That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.